I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Ted Allen, host of the Food Network show Chopped, and whose latest book is In My Kitchen, 100 Recipes and Discoveries for Passionate Cooks. He's joined in conversation by chef and author Joey Altman. And now, join Joey Altman on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Ted Allen.
Without further ado, 4 courses, 3 chefs, and only one chance to win the challenge. Create an unforgettable meal from ingredients inside these baskets before time runs out. That introduction has thrust our guest, Ted Allen, from the chorus line of reality TV personalities to the front and center spotlight on the stage of Food TV. Starting out as a journalist with a master's from NYU, Ted landed a job with the Chicago Weekly doing restaurant reviews with 3 other people collectively known as the Famished Four. One of these starving people, Barry Rice, would later become his husband and collaborator on many future projects, including his latest book, In My Kitchen, 100 Recipes and Discoveries for Passionate Cooks. Ted first went national with his hugely popular series in Esquire magazine with articles, Things a Man Should Know, and that eventually became a series of books. Then in 2003, people got to see what Ted Allen looked and cooked like on Bravo Network's breakout smash Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, where Ted, along with 4 other gay crusaders, helped transform America's lovable cavemen into swarthy metrosexuals, taking thousands of jobs away from girlfriends and wives, whom I believe much appreciated the outsourcing of such work. Ted then started appearing on Food Network shows such as Iron Chef America and hosting his own show, Food Detectives, where he, along with the help of experts, scientifically proved or debunked popular food myths and urban legends. But it was in January of 2009 when Food Network launched their new chef competition show, Chopped, that Ted Allen became a household name. The show caught on with audiences in a big way. Within just a few seasons, became one of Food Network's most popular shows, and it has grown a loyal and passionate fan base of millions, some of you here tonight. And I'd like you all to help me please welcome chef, author, TV personality, Ted Allen.
Thank you all for coming. It's great to be here.
So you were raised in the Midwest,
yes.
Born in Ohio, raised in Carmel, Indiana. Your mother is Southern, and you mentioned in a lot of different pieces I've read that she was a big influence on your appreciation for food. Tell us about the food in your household growing up.
Well, Mom was mainly the force that encouraged my sister and me to cook from an early age. And if you have kids, I hope you encourage them to cook. They tend to love it, most kids. We have a lot of kids watching Food Network, which is why they won't let us say dirty words. But when we're not rolling, man, we're filthy.
Surprise.
Yeah, right. And the only one who can get away with a dick joke on Food Network is Paula Deen, because then they have to be very gentle jokes. But body Southern women can do things that the rest of us can't. My mom was a very simple, classic, Southern cook. Not a lot of butter like Paula. Nothing. She wasn't very adventuresome, and she also was from the generation which I hold responsible for a lot of processed junk. But my mom is deeply into vegetables, and she actually she uses more processed stuff than she should. But she's not somebody who loves cooking. She likes it okay, and she does it because it's necessary to be alive.
But was the hospitality aspect of her Southern upbringing something that imbibed you?
Not really.
No.
Okay. My parents were my father's now no longer with us, but my mom thankfully is. My parents are shy people. My parents, my dad was an accountant. My mom, they're very down to earth people. My dad made great money, but did not ever flaunt it. And they have a nice house. She lives in the same house that we moved to in 1972. And it's nice, and it's on a wooded lot. It's not in the fabulous part of Carmel. Carmel is sort of like the fancy suburb of Indianapolis. But not our neighborhood. We're from the rough part of Carmel.
Carmel by the lot as opposed to Carmel by the sea.
So, no, not really. They rarely threw parties.
So where did you get your love of food and your passion for being involved in making it your life's work? Or was that a happy accident?
It happened in Chicago, where I lived for 14 years, a city that I dearly love and always will. It's a great city. Where I worked at... it really took root when I got a job at Chicago Magazine, which, much like San Francisco Magazine, is pretty much the restaurant Bible of the city. And food so permeates the culture at that magazine that I found myself going out to interview great chefs like Paul Bartolotta and Sarah Stegner, and I don't know if these names are going to be familiar here. And I just fell in love with the culture of restaurants and chefs and the kind of people they are, which is bawdy, raucous, crazy. Chefs are insane, but but they're good to have as
friends.
Everything
Anthony Bourdain told us about is true. And
absolutely.
We know that. We like that about chefs.
They're my kind of people. I'm a journalist by training and trade, and I've worked at newspapers and magazines, and particularly newspapers are places where everybody there is dorky and funny and really smart and likes a beer and just my kind of people. And chefs are a lot like that. Only they're much more obese.
So you were doing the restaurant reviews with the Famished Four, and then you decided you wanted to get a little bit more exposure, and you started chasing after more national publications, and then you landed at Esquire magazine. And how did that whole Men Things Should Know come about?
Well, I wanted exposure, but I also wanted to be paid more than $17,000 a year, which was my starting salary.
You bastard.
I know, right? That was my starting salary at the community newspaper I worked at. I got really lucky, but I also showed some hustle, and this is something that I love to tell journalism students about, although actually now journalism is so depressing, I don't want to talk to journalism students, but it applies to anybody who's trying to get work, and at a time when it's not so easy to find work, it's really good advice, I think. I got my I got a contract with Esquire magazine, which means that I got a check, which means I made $80,000 a year, and the check came every month, whether I did any work or not. Normally, in freelance writing, you don't get paid until you write, and you make $2 a word, which is, that's on the national level, which is what they've paid since approximately 1968. And I'm not even kidding about that. So how do I become one of the roughly 8 people who have a contract at the best men's national magazine in history? It was very fortunate. What I did was I identified a few magazines that I liked, and I begged for informational interviews, and I landed one with a guy named Scott Omelanek, who worked at GQ. I didn't get any work out of him for 6 months. I pitched him stories, nothing panned out. Then I pitched him a story about the Adventurers Club in Chicago, and I'm sure you have a version of that here. In New York, it's the Explorers Club. This is a club for rich guys who like to go kill antelopes, and they build a little clubhouse where they hang the dead antelopes on the wall, and they have mistresses, and they drink too much, and they think they're Ernest Hemingway.
And then Ted Nugent plays a song at the end of the night, and it's all...
No. These are the guys who drink, $900 scotch, and they think they're Ernest Hemingway, which is not necessarily the most charming people to be around, but they do tell great stories, and they're fun to have a drink with, and they're perfect for a magazine like GQ, which is always desperately trying to convince its readers that, no, you're not gay. It's not gay that you read.
Right. You're so, taking all my questions away.
So I pitched a good story for the magazine, and I knocked it out of the park. I worked my butt off on it, just in front of the book story. A few months later, he offered me a $30,000 part-time gig with Esquire, and then he offered me... I left it out a step. In the meantime, David Granger became the editor-in-chief of Esquire, and he brought Scott along with him as his number three man. And Scott wanted a personal writer boy at his beck and call, so I became that boy, and then I became that full-time boy, and it was a thrill. And also, so I got to write about Things a Man Should Know is basically what Esquire has been teaching men since 1933, how to make a cocktail, how to treat women, how to ogle women and not get caught. I don't know.
So you just distilled it down to this very sort of concentrated, easy-to-read, quick little summation of a monthly or however often the column came out for people to sort of easily digestible and got it.
Okay. Yeah, it was a feature in
steps.
It was a feature in the magazine that we then turned into these little books that now are probably really dated, but fun little nuggets of advice for guys. Like my favorite of which was... don't leave that bolo... You know what a bolo tie is? The string tie? It said, don't leave that bolo tie in your dresser drawer. You could die. Someone could find it.
So there's never like, really an appropriate opportunity unless you're going to a costume party to wear a bolo tie.
Well, you know, part of being stylish, and I'm not saying I am, is knowing the rules and knowing how, whether you can pull off breaking them.
Okay, with that, what are the three tips everyone should know, every man in this room, or maybe it's universal gender. What should we know about style that we could walk out of here going,
ah,
okay, that was worth the price of admission right there.
Well, I gave you one already.
No bolo tie?
No.
Who
no,
didn't
no,
know that?
That's actually two.
Okay.
Because it's so costumey. I mean, if you live in Dallas, you know, knock yourself out. And, I mean, really knock yourself out, please. But, if you live in Dallas, what's wrong with you? I think that the most general one is the one that I just said. If you care about style, I so admire people who can just effortlessly wear canary yellow pants and a fedora and red scarves and look cool. I haven't figured out how to do that. What are you doing? Now, pink. Now, look at that. I just had some Pepto-Bismol, by the way.
I bet you it didn't taste as good as that.
You look fabulous. But, you know, I mean, knowing the basic, like, I mean, I remember Esquire really helped me get the Queer Eye job, very much so, partly because the creators of Queer Eye just liked that magazine, but also partly because I had worked there for 6 or 7 years already.
It was sort of the blueprint for Queer Eye.
Well, kind of. Yes, you're righter than you know. Yes, it was.
I'm right.
Which brings up something else I want to talk about. But the little rules, like, okay, let's say you're a gentleman wearing a three-button suit, and this is the kind of tip that Carson would teach you. Sometimes, always, never. Sometimes you button the top one, you always button the middle one, you never button the bottom one.
That is why? What a friend of mine quoted before I told him I was doing this interview. So I love that. The one thing, sometimes, always, never.
See, and you'll never forget that.
That was indelible.
So that's worth the price of admission.
Okay, but that's one.
But the little things like that, well, I think the idea of understanding rules like that, but knowing that you're cool enough to break them and button the damn thing all the way to your neck if you want, because you're cool. One of the things that's great about working in broadcasting, which I'm sure you've realized from your outfit, obviously, is that you can wear whatever the hell you want.
I have to tell you, I have never stressed more about getting dressed for anyone ever.
Why? I'm the food guy.
I go out in pajamas with my wife to flirtily, whatever, but I was like, what do I wear tonight? He's going to just berate me.
No, that's Carson. I'm the food guy. Carson
know,
would be berating
you. You all have that style.
Carson would be undressing you. Or trying.
Is this? I thought I did.
You look
a good
fabulous.
Job.
I'm just kidding.
Thank you.
The thing is, but it is true that when you work in television, I could wear this to a black tie party and nobody would say anything. They might, the old people might mutter, and I wouldn't. I wouldn't do that actually because that's kind of a douchey move. But
right, yeah, and you're not that.
Not usually. Remind me, but we'll get back to that subject in a second.
So, huge success in the printed world. What was your attraction to TV?
You know, I still to this day wonder what it was that was motivating me because... Because
you went out for it. You auditioned for this show.
I busted my ass to get on Queer Eye. And,
yeah.
I ruined two vacations. I had...
Of other people's or your own?
Mine and Barry's.
Okay.
We were going to do a three-week tour of Europe from Vienna to Prague to various places in Germany, various other... and we did still go to Prague, didn't go to Vienna. Wasted our time going to that stupid castle Neuschwanstein.
I've been there.
Stupid. That stupid thing. It's only 100 years old. My house is older than that castle.
But it was the inspiration for Disney.
I know. It's beautiful, but it's not old. And it was built for this insane prince who never even lived there. It's just fake. We drove 6 hours out of our way.
But for Americans, that's old.
Oh, my God. Not for me. My house was built in 1879. So a friend sent me a casting notice for Queer Eye. I was living in Chicago. When you live in Chicago and you work for Esquire, which is in New York, it's always nice to go get some FaceTime with your boss so they remember who you are. And I just thought, oh, I'll just go audition for this show for a part that I won't get, for a show with a very provocative name that will never get aired, and it'll just be funny. And I'll spend some time with Granger, and it'll all be great. So I will never forget that I walked into this airless conference room at Bravo. That 500 people auditioned for Queer Eye. They weren't all in the conference room at that moment, thankfully, but it was very stuffy.
500, wow.
500 people auditioned for Queer Eye, at least. Some people say 600. And I'll never forget, we're all kind of sitting there eyeing each other warily, and it's not very comfortable, and we're reading the paper and whatever, when Carson walks in the room. Carson, it's very hot, as I said. Carson was wearing...
Was he already hired at this point?
No.
Okay, so he was...
Carson walks in the room, he's wearing Gucci slides, He's wearing Ralph Lauren flowing pants with giant blue and white hibiscuses on them. Basically like a blousy pirate shirt with big white, you know, blousy gauzy shirt and giant Chanel sunglasses and carrying a Louis Vuitton duffel bag. And he walks into the room and he hurls the duffel bag into the middle of the conference room table and says, "I just think it's adorable that you queens think you still have a chance at this part."
Wow.
And he was right.
Wow.
Carson and I were the first two people cast on the show. And I sometimes think that it might be because we, in several ways, we kind of bookend each other, Carson and me.
How is There's it like orbiting around that planet?
We contrast slightly, yes. Carson and me.
Yeah. Well, that was the beauty of that show, that there was this depiction of, because I think up until that point, many people had a very sort of two-dimensional idea of what being a gay man was like. And here was this, you know, these five gay guys who all were very, very different personalities, very different sort of attitudes about things. And so it just, I think it humanized gays in a really positive way.
You know, we never set out thinking that we were important or that we were proud that we were out. We were the first show ever to have five that many openly gay people on TV being themselves. And I think we remain that, the first and only of that nature. But let me tell you, yesterday I was in Kansas City. I did a normal book signing. Then I went to did a book signing at a private home that was throwing a party for the AIDS walk. The house was full of like 250 adorable gay guys. Which I was very upset about. In perfect...
You were hoping 300?
Yeah, exactly. And lots of them are young and cute, and they're all wearing just perfect clothes because they have to impress each other. And it was great. And it's like, you know... And one of the guys comes up to me, and he's like 25 years old. Beautiful guy. And he comes up to me and he says, you know... And we take a picture, and then he says, you know what? I just want to tell you that I come from a very conservative family, and my parents fell in love with Queer Eye, and it was the thing that made it possible for me to come out to them. And I've heard that from thousands of people. And I'm never prouder and I'm never more tingly and welled up with tears when I hear that, because that is just so, you have to understand, we live in a bubble. You know this. You live in San Francisco. I live in New York City. It's not easy for teenagers
right.
to be gay or to be different or to be big or tall or short or anything, but especially gay. Even today, look at this Mitt Romney business. I mean, really, it's better than that now, but it ain't perfect. And to have a kid tell me that, to think that we played a part in that, is just overwhelming. It's really cool.
Yeah, well, very, congratulations very cool. to you all, and I can understand how that makes you all feel so proud of the work and the byproduct of what came out of what was seemingly imaginably a lark and just a good time for a fun show.
And I'm a big moneymaker for that money grubbing network. And also
who's driving the bitter bus?
Now I love him. I'll tell you what, between you and me, we made 99
and my 100 friends here.
Well, that's who I'm talking to. Okay. We made 99 episodes of Queer Eye. And next July will be our 10th anniversary. What do you think I'm talking to Bravo about right now? We gotta do one. No, 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 not that. With that musical, no.
Queer Eye meets the Sex and the City girls, and all hell breaks loose in Hell's Kitchen.
It's a JCC. It's gotta be a musical. Yeah, exactly. All things just keep getting better. No, I really think we should. That if Bravo would be willing to pay to spend the money this would cost, and it might not be. That's not their model. Currently, they'd like to do shows about people that they don't pay, who are all bitchy housewives, but. which I don't really watch, but I think it would be really cool. 10th anniversary, one time only, gold-plated Denali, and the worst straight guy in America. And you could have a
Mitt Romney. A Mitt Romney makeover. Cut his hair off. Knock him down, cut his hair.
Oh.
You're listening to Ted Allen, host of the Food Network show Chopped, and whose latest book is In My Kitchen, 100 Recipes and Discoveries for Passionate Cooks. He's joined in conversation by chef and author Joey Altman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I'm going to fast forward because I know a lot of people here are huge fans of the show that you have become a household name in, Chopped. And the first thing I want to ask you about Chopped is I know the show had a different concept when it was first sort of put on the blackboard of what it was going to be,
yes,
than what actually wound up on TV. Can you share with us what the original concept, because I think it's really hysterical.
Yeah. Yes, I will. The show was created by my friend Linda Lee, who was an executive producer of Queer Eye, and who is brilliant, and one of the, those rare television executives who is not a douchebag. I say that with affection. I mean that in the nicest way. So the original version of Chopped, which was Linda's fault, was and they shot a pilot of this. Chopped was set in a fancy mansion, and the chefs arrived in chauffeured limousines, and the host of the show, which was not me, was the butler of the house, and he's always holding a chihuahua in every scene. And when somebody got chopped, their dish was fed to the chihuahua. True story.
And why that didn't become what Bravo chose?
I know, right? Food Network got that pilot.
Food Network got it.
The executive, right? The executive at Food Network who greenlighted that pilot is no longer with the company.
So he greenlighted that pilot, but then how did it? Who made the decision? Lose the guy and the chihuahua. Let's make it more.
It's the same people that run Food Network now. They got that and they thought, oh, this is just too weird. And plus, you can't feed people food to a chihuahua. That's not healthy for dogs.
Right. It's insulting the people and the chihuahua.
Yeah, but it's hysterical. I've actually seen the pilot. It was really funny. It's just too weird. Way too weird. But they saw in the show a kernel of something that they liked. And by the way, there's a history from the early days of the network of Ready, Set, Cook,
right,
which is similar.
Right.
Our show is not earth-shatteringly creative or different from other culinary competitions, but it does now have its own identity, I think. And it's a show that gives you a payoff with every episode. Our judges are brilliant. They're some of the best chefs in America.
There'd be some people here I know that would beg to differ about the judges. And I'm sure
that's fine.
That must be pretty controversial.
We'll
get to that in a
minute. Well, I think Simon Cowell is a jerk too, you know? And
But he is brilliant. I mean, he does know what he's talking
absolutely
about.
Absolutely.
Right.
Actually, Alex can be a pain in the neck. I mean, she talks way too long, but you can't deny her brilliance. And if you tasted her food, you'd know what I'm talking about.
Right, right. But I think everybody sort of looks at the dish that's being prepared and they immediately come up with what they think of it. And then when they hear a judge sort of go off the ranch, they take issue with that.
Aha! No, wait, but I've never thought of that. That's actually very insightful. I never thought of that happening where you get a dissonance where you think something looks great and then Mark Murphy trashes it and that could offend you a little bit.
Absolutely.
That is an interesting part of the psychology that never occurred to me. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Going to use that.
It's all yours.
I'll credit you.
Okay, when it first came out, I have to tell you that I thought, oh God, here comes another competition show to be heaped on the 100 other competition shows. And it had a low budget kind of look to it. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed,
as low as some shows on Food Network, though. I think our set's pretty cool.
Now it is. When it first came on.
But I mean, a lot of shows on Food Network have pipe and drape.
Right, sure.
It's not the most stylish.
But it's all
network.
Close up. Food porn anyway, so that people don't pay attention. But anyway, my point is that when it first came out, I was like, oh, you know, this doesn't really look interesting. And then when I started watching it, I was really surprised on how compelling the concept was of, you know, the conceit of having four ingredients. And it wasn't just like America's Top Chef or the Iron Chef where you have to, you know, you have a missed one ingredient that you could do anything to. Here you have four ingredients that you have to use all of it in some amount.
And bring them together.
And bring them together. And I thought that was a great vehicle to have an insight on how chefs think moment to moment, day to day in their restaurants. Trying to come up with something that is going to be delicious and still sort of provocative, innovative, without being too far out there and understanding the flavor profiles of each of your ingredients and how they behave together, and that gave the average viewer, I think, a really good insight to how that could work, putting licorice, blueberries, oxtail, and beer together, you know?
Well, and that would be a hard enough competition if all the ingredients did go together logically and were all fabulous. Then we throw into the mix that we give you gummy bears, Rocky Mountain oysters, rattlesnakes, you know, the joke, the water cooler ingredient, the thing that everyone's like, oh my God, they have to cook with Doritos, you know?
I love Doritos.
And I used to want them just to not use those ingredients because I felt they disrespected our craft.
Right. I could see that. And sort of, it was a silly sort of kind of thing.
But I quickly realized that, first of all, the audience loves it. And right. it's relatable, too. We all have had Doritos. We all have had these things.
Stuck with gummy bears and chicken breasts. Somebody tell me what to do.
I mean, I hope we haven't cooked with them too much. But more importantly, that chefs are very competitive people who, if you throw them a challenge like that, hey, can you cook with this crappy ingredient? They're going to say, you bet I can.
If she has to, I will.
You know, there's a lot of... So they don't mind. And they get it, right. and they don't whine about it.
Right. Well, that being said, I have a little mystery basket here for you that I just like.
Uh-oh.
I mean, you don't have to do any cooking, but just to sort of walk us through how you would approach this sort of, you know, competition.
I'd be delighted.
You know, so say, you know, four courses, four chefs, three courses, 30 minutes. So
chefs, please open your baskets.
Right. You have the matzah.
By the way, nice job on the cold open. I heard you there.
Thank
four
you,
chefs,
Thank
three
you.
Courses, only one chance to win.
Right. My daughter says, you say that one more time, I'm going to punch you in the mouth.
Should I do the... There, when I read the rules on Chopped, I'm not even conscious of what I'm saying.
Right.
Because I've said it so many times right. now, you know, it's just, and it's so weird. It's almost like being an out of body experience where I could literally just, start singing, you know, Creedence Clearwater songs.
It's your mantra.
Myself. It's like, there are three rounds, appetizer, entree, and dessert. Each course comes with its own basket of mystery ingredients.
The voice.
It's so weird. What do you got?
Okay,
we have
some Manischewitz Concord grape wine. We have some matzah meal and soup mix, a little bit of borscht, a little gefilte fish, Mrs. Adler's special sweet recipe.
You got to get this goyim stuff out of here. Let's get this out of here.
And
this that's no good.
The kicker ingredient, a little halva.
A little halva, okay. Yeah. And now this is more than four ingredients, first of all.
This is my house.
Oh, man.
My rules.
It's tougher than Chopped. Okay. And what course?
This is Chopped.
So is this the appetizer course then?
You pick. So, I mean, but so how, what?
Well, I'm not making dessert from this.
If I tell you, you will.
All right.
No, so entree or a course.
Well, the first problem with most of our mystery basket ingredients is that they rarely do they suggest a format.
Right.
For a dish. Usually it's a bunch of little condiment-y kind of things that don't say, okay, this will lend
Start
itself
here.
To right. a sandwich or lend itself to a soup. It's usually missing a structure, like, you know, that's right. usually the biggest problem, which is why you got to go to the pantry for things. But here...
But it's also the reason why the dishes are so different, and that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah, and they put a lot of thought into those mystery basket ingredients. It's the Food Network's culinary department. Now, the first problem I have with this is that these are all packaged, processed foods, which none of us food people like. But I'll work with you here.
You don't have to work too long. We have limited time here.
I don't want to miss questions. Now, we have some nice elements in that, okay, well, we've got a protein in our gefilte fish, but we want to try. We don't want to see a big lump of gefilte fish on the plate. It needs to be... No, but that's not the way the
right.
contest works.
Exactly.
This needs to be transformed into something else.
Right.
And although it does suggest that a soup might be a good option, is this in, I don't know what kind of liquid this is. You would make your own. So, you make your own. I mean, that's why you're a cook, you know. Nobody drinks Manischewitz unless you're, you know.
Redux?
Oh, really? Really like it? It's so sweet, though. The Manischewitz, I would probably reduce it and turn it into a gastrique.
A drizzle or something.
Some
like
kind
that.
Of a, exactly. a sauce with some sweet, maybe get some beef stock into it or something. I haven't had enough time, but then I guess you don't have much time at Chopped, do you? Okay. So, well, the matzo ball soup mix, so, geez, but we have gefilte and matzo. Maybe get this into some kind of a dough. Use this and make some kind of dough, make a flatbread, but what do you know? We also have matzahs.
How about we make a tempura batter? We fry bits of, like, chunks of the gefilte fish, float it in the borscht with the reduction of the manischewitz. We crumble a little halva, and we make a crumble of matzah and halva.
You bastard.
Crumble.
You bastard. You've been working on this for 3 days.
Win! I win!
I tell you, a lot of people have asked me if I would ever compete on Chopped, and I'm getting a lot more confident about my cooking. And
you're a good cook.
I also have an enormous advantage, having been present for every episode, and I know a lot of the pitfalls. So I would consider it. My big issue is who's going to be the host. As a person who likes their. No, it's definitely not going to be you.
Let me think.
It's definitely not going to be you.
Prompt mind. Okay, so. You mentioned that you got to see all these chefs. Tell us about, and you don't have to name names, but it would be preferred if you did, watching somebody and you knew immediately, this is going to be ugly. What was that kind of scenario where you just saw it all go into hell in a handbasket?
Oh, boy.
How much crying happens on the set?
Oh, the producers love crying. We have one producer, our floor producer, whose job it is to torment us with stuff that she wants us to say, Vivian Sorensen. I call her.
She used to work for Barbara Walters or something?
No, she's worse than that. I call her the vivisectionist. She's this little elfin creature who comes up to the desk and says, like, I think he just dropped the steak. You know, she's like, guys, she's trying to manically to get our attention because we don't pay attention to her. She's like, guys, they just dropped the steak. What were we talking about again?
You're watching these chefs, and what are the telltale signs of
that it's going to be a shit show?
Right. Or the contestant is going to just completely implode.
We had a guy who come on. I mean, well, first of all fairness, a lot of people. One of the great things about restaurant kitchens is that they are a gateway for so many people into the economy. And I'm talking about immigrants, I'm also talking about people who are insane.
Right.
And who really are just not otherwise drug addicts.
It's the halfway house to the halfway house.
Totally. The difference being that the culture enables continued drug abuse and, you know, weird behavior. But, I remember one guy who... The TV producer are always thinking about characters and story. They care about that more than they care about cooking. Whereas what I and my judges care about is the food. And there's an interesting tension there because they're always trying to say, like, so we joke with Vivian all the time about she's always trying to get people to cry. And so she'll come up with questions like, so how much cancer did you have? I mean, I kid, but I'm always, and some of our viewers complain about it, and rightly so, because I just want to cook the damn food. I don't want this tearjerker stuff, but it is a necessary part.
Do they prod the judges to be meaner than they want to be?
No. No one can make our judges do anything that they don't want to do.
Okay. Because sometimes
Scott would say, like, go fuck yourself. That's an Italian
I know the
stereotype
right.
as opposed to the Jewish ones we were doing before.
Right.
The judges make all the decisions themselves.
I understand it takes 90 minutes for them to come up with an answer to each segment of the show?
Well, it's never that bad unless there's a big argument. Usually, it's...
So how long does it take the jury? How long is the jury out before they go, that person?
It's usually more like 30 minutes.
Okay.
And sometimes it's obvious. But actually, one of the great things about doing this, and one of the things that makes it intellectually stimulating, is that it's often extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, well, this dish was better than that dish. It's not...
So much of it is subjective,
And sometimes someone will leave off a mystery ingredient and will still pass them along because somebody else committed an atrocity that was even worse.
Right.
But, you know, it's a very interesting exercise talking about people's cooking and why it succeeded and why it didn't. And there are issues of texture and flavors coming together, and did they use all four ingredients in a way where they tried to hide them in something or where they truly elevated them? And there's a principle in art that Brian Eno wrote that's the idea of flaunt the imperfection.
Right.
Where you take the problem and you just embrace it head on and say, okay, you've given me Rocky Mountain oysters, which are sheep's balls. Okay. That's, to me, a problem. It's not
more than it was to the sheep that you have them.
But I'm sorry, what was the question?
You answered it.
Okay, good.
So the one thing that I think Chopped also did amazingly well was the Lunch Lady episode.
Oh.
How did that explode? It was just amazing.
I'm so glad.
For people who don't know, this was a Chopped episode where they featured four lunch ladies from public schools who came on there. One of them, I understand, came on against her will. She didn't want it, but her boss made her come on the show. And she was like the reluctant contestant. But you got an insight into what these women do and how underpaid and underappreciated, but how they still do it because they just love what they do and they see the value in their work. Even if they don't understand the big, huge picture of it, they just see the happy kids' faces. And it was just, if you didn't cry at the end of this show, you didn't have a heartbeat.
Thank you for bringing that up. I've been in television for 9 years now. A lot of episodes of a lot of shows that were emotional. I'd never once shed a tear on TV until that episode. And I just joked about Vivian Sorensen, but that was her baby. And she knew going in, she knew how emotional that wallop was going to be. Myself and the judges had no clue until those women walked in the room, and that's made it even more special. We had Sam Cass, the Obama's personal chef, right, as one of our judges. And we helped to get across some of Mrs. Obama's messages about getting kids to exercise and working to get a little more money into the school lunch programs, because that's where a lot of poor kids is the only place they get any food. Right. And by the way, the White House has successfully pushed through an initiative that this fall will increase the spending on school lunches by 6 cents a meal, which sounds like nothing. It's not. It will make a material improvement. You're going to see chicken breast instead of chicken nuggets. You're going to see apples instead of something junky.
Ketchup will no longer be a vegetable, hopefully.
Ketchup will no longer be a vegetable. So the thing about this that really blew us away, and I have to give credit also to Mark Murphy, those women walked in the room and we looked at them and watched them cook the first round. And they did an amazing job. They all plated. The food was good. And Mark said, okay, and we're all... And lunch ladies got respect from nobody when I went to school. The kids mocked them for the hairnets. The food was bad. It's not their fault. They're not even, most of them, trained to cook. They're trained to reheat processed junk like this. And I'm saying it only because it's processed. They are paid nothing. They get no respect from administrators, from politicians. They're called lunch ladies. That's not a very good title.
Pretty derogatory.
And so Mark Murphy said, first of all, you people are not going to be called lunch ladies anymore today. You are school chefs, and you have executed the work of chefs, creative, passionate cooks for us today. And so you're school chefs. We're already starting to tear up at this point. And then these women tell their stories about the terrible budgets that they have and how much they love their kids.
One woman said that the prize money is more than she makes in a year, and that was $10,000.
I mean, the ultimate winner of the show, Cheryl Barbara, these were all school chefs from New Haven, Connecticut, which is a town that has its problems. Cheryl...
Well, there's one from New Jersey as well.
Yeah, but there are lots of them now. Which makes this all the more important. Cheryl spends her own money to fill backpacks full of food that the poor kids can take home and have something to eat over the weekend,
right,
and she puts them in backpacks so other kids won't know about it,
right,
and they won't be stigmatized because of that.
Right.
That show was awesome, and thank you, Vivian, for it, and thank you for
You're watching
welcome. It. If you haven't seen it, you can probably find it online. I'm very proud of that show.
And there was one other thing that one of the school chefs said that they were so looked down upon, they weren't even allowed in the teacher's room.
Yeah, they wouldn't allow them in the teacher's lounge. I mean, these people play an enormous role in the health of our kids.
Yeah.
Why do we want to feed American school children bad food? Why? Because our kids live in the white suburbs and they get food that's pretty decent and we don't care about inner city kids? Is that it? Is that the way it is? I mean, with that.
It's off the radar. It's sort of handled, and I think. And thank you for putting it on the radar. Okay, I just wanted to.
Well, we got a moment to sort of say something. You know, there's a lot of politics in food, and in the way food's handled, and the way food's regulated, and the way food's regarded. And you know, I'm the host of a show that's watched by all kinds of people, and I try to be respectful of other people's points of view. But I'm in San Francisco, so I can actually tell the truth.
Amen, brother.
Amen.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Ted Allen, host of the Food Network show Chopped, and whose latest book is In My Kitchen, 100 Recipes and Discoveries for Passionate Cooks. He's joined in conversation by chef and author Joey Altman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Okay, for the few minutes we have left, I just want to quickly just tell you how much I love your book, and here's some of the things that I love about your book, and I want you to comment if there is a comment. I love the chef tips. It's one of the things that I tried to do in my book as well, and I think you did a great job, thought of things that I didn't think of. Cutting boards. You make a little thing about cutting boards. No glass. My sister-in-law is here. The first time I cooked at her house, she had one of the glass bubbly, you know, the cheese boards that was her cutting board. And you tell people that how important it is to have just a good cutting board.
Well, you might as well have a concrete cutting board. You're going to ruin your knife in about a minute. That came from Queer Eye, actually. I kept finding people cutting things on those nubbly glass boards. You got to use an actual cut. It needs to be wood or plastic or something that won't dull your knife.
Right, and then you talked about how having the right tools just makes it less toilsome, it's more fun, and it's just better. And then the other thing that I really love is you're encouraging people to make things at home that you wouldn't normally think of making. And one of the things that I've been doing a lot of lately is ricotta cheese, homemade ricotta cheese. It's the simplest, easiest thing to do, and the difference between fresh-made ricotta cheese in your home that you can do in 20 minutes versus what you pay for at Whole Foods or that Polio thing is night and day, and it's fantastic. And your recipe is so simple, and it works every time, and it's brilliant. And you could put it on an old ski boot, and it will just taste delicious.
It's good stuff.
How to make vinegar?
Yes, from wine,
from leftover wine of any kind, champagne, dessert wines, whatever. You can put it in there, and you talk about how you can if you don't have a organic vinegar that has a little bit of the mother where you can source it, so you can get that process going. Mm-hmm. And you explain it really well. Marshmallows. You simplify the recipe on how to make marshmallows. What was the reason why you wanted to include marshmallows?
Well, I mean, you've seen this before on shows like Martha Stewart, but homemade marshmallows are, like almost everything else, are infinitely better than the stuff you buy in the store. And you might say, well, I don't have time to do that. But if you do it once and you taste it, you realize that the quality, it's just a completely different species. I mean, the whole idea of the book, so many of the cookbooks out there, it's as if their only goal is to get you out of the kitchen as quickly as possible. I wanted to write a book for people who love to cook, or maybe who could be inspired to love to cook and learn a little more about it. And nobody's a bad cook. I hate it when people say I'm a bad cook. You just haven't had the time yet, or maybe the motivation to practice.
Or the right recipes.
Maybe it's never occurred to you to think this way. Maybe you do come from my mom's generation where we were trying to escape the kitchen. I'm not saying that I want you to slaughter your own hogs.
Well, here's the other thing that I love about your
book.
And I made sure this was the same with my book. There's not one recipe in his book that starts with day one.
Yeah. That's true.
Whereas so many books, you see day one, go out, hunt it down, slaughter it, drag it back.
And I may have one or two, but very few recipes that refer you to a different recipe in the book. I hate that.
Right.
You really should read recipes all the way through before you start, because then otherwise you're going to be halfway through and you're going to be sauteing something. And you're like, oh, shit, I was supposed to make my own mayonnaise.
Or that chutney.
But the basic idea of the book was that if I have a day off, you know, a lot of people might go play baseball or golf or mow the lawn that's not fun. Sleep in a hammock. I want to be in my kitchen. I'm on the phone calling my friends to come over and bring armloads of food. I'm cranking the stereo. I'm opening the wine, and I'm never happier. And I like food that takes a long time to develop the flavor. I love nurturing food. I like putting pork shoulder in my smoker and cooking it for 8 hours and smelling that sweet smoke. And I like, you know, making chicken soup which doesn't take that long. I like making Italian Sunday gravy, where you it's not a tomato sauce at all. The real Italian, and how many Italians do we have? We must have a couple. So your nonna the sauce your nonna made on Sunday, where you make a, it's really about the sofrito, which is the saute of onions and celery and garlic that you cook in olive oil for about 8 minutes till it's soft. And then you add 12 cups of chicken stock to that, and you reduce 12 cups down to 6 cups, which is why you have to use low sodium stock and why it's even better to make your own. And it's just not that hard to make stuff like that. But that discovery that's what that sauce is about was a big deal for me, and I learned it from Lydia Bastianich, not personally, unfortunately. That would have been very cool. I've met her, but she doesn't teach me to cook. So you'd reduce the stock down to 6 cups, and then you add a single regular-sized can of tomatoes to that. That's a supporting actor. It's not a tomato sauce. It's a sauce that's much deeper and more interesting and has many complex flavors. And as you make a sauce like that, if I could give you any advice as a home cook, the most important thing, we talk about this on Chopped all the time, is to stick a spoon in there and taste as you're going. And when you get more comfortable in your kitchen, you begin to realize, you know what this needs? It's just a little bit of acidity, a little tanginess. Let's splash just a tablespoon of red wine vinegar in there. Yeah, there we go. Now, how's the salt level? You know, and does it, you know, and you got to think about the salt level for someone who's going to eat 22 spoonfuls of it, not just the one that you're tasting. That's a really important thing to come to learn. The other thing that I'll suggest that I've learned from Scott Conant and Alex Guarnaschelli, every recipe that for pasta tells you to generously salt the water that you cook the pasta in, but they never tell you how generously or give you any idea what it really needs.
I say like the seawater.
The fact, God damn it, you just stole my punchline. Actually, you're close. Alex told me seawater. Scott Conant prefers, he thinks that's a little too salty.
Oh.
No, salty. No, he said, what he said was, and this is appropriate at JCC, he said, you get the water boiling, add salt, and then taste it with your spoon until it tastes as salty as a good chicken soup. That's a lot of salt. That's how much salt you need for your pasta to be correct. And I speak this very pedantically, not because I developed the knowledge. I stole it from Scott. But he knows. And that's why he can charge you $38 for a bowl of spaghetti.
We have time for some questions.
Some questions?
Just put your hands up and Siri and I will come find you.
Hi, Ted.
Hello.
My wife and I love your show. We have done mystery baskets for each other and had fun with that. So
my kind of food, dork.
It's totally great.
Thank you, sir.
So I have a quick question is, although it is definitely part of the fun of the format, I've often wondered how contestants are expected to cook meat decently when they've only got 30 minutes, and they're often criticized for this is undercooked meat. I mean, what do you expect in 30 minutes? How do you balance the challenge of the time with cooking something properly like that?
Well, this is when our All-Stars competition really brings to light how vastly better our judges are than our average contestant, and how better the other Food Network stars like Ann Burrell and Robert Irvine are, and why they are Food Network stars. And in particular, it brings to light why these people understand the nature of these fast competitions in a way that a restaurant chef doesn't yet. And that is, if we give you a breast of lamb or a pork shoulder and tell you have to cook it in 30 minutes, you can't. And it's amazing how many people try to cook it the way they normally would, which is to sear it off and stick it in the oven at 250. Dude. You can't. What you have to do is have the presence of mind to think, all right, I have only basically two options. I can use the meat grinder and turn it into a sausage, or I can cut it into a thin paillard and pound the heck out of it with a pounder, because we're talking about tough cuts of meat. And that's part of the challenge and part of the reason the show is staggeringly difficult. If we give you a rack of pork or a big roast, dude, it's 30 minutes. It's not going to happen the way you're accustomed to doing it. That's part of the challenge. You need to figure out and when I tell chefs to practice for Chopped, that's what I tell them, is don't even think about what's in the basket, because you're never going to be able to predict. Sometimes it's awesome what's in the basket. It's ribeye steak and Dijon mustard and black pepper. Usually it isn't. What you need to understand is what 20 minutes is. You need to have in your head the idea that you might get a tough cut, or a tiny little fish that's a real bitch to fillet. You need to prepare for the time frame even more than for the ingredients. That's a good question. Yes.
Hi. I've been a fan of you since Queer Eye days, and I loved your last book. I can't wait to cook stuff out of your next book.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. We only see 40 minutes on Chopped. How long does it take to actually film an episode?
It takes about 12 hours to shoot an episode. It's a tough day.
Oh, wow. Second, what's the weirdest ingredient you've seen in the baskets?
You know, it gets kind of hard to pick one when you've had...
Rocky Mountain oysters.
We've had Rocky Mountain oysters, Doug testicles, rattlesnake, which, by the way, is a useless thing to eat. There's no reason to eat rattlesnake. It has no flavor. It costs $100 a snake.
Right.
And it's got a skeleton running down. I mean, why would you do that? Unless you're caught in the desert or something.
Right.
In which
last
case,
resort food.
Yeah. I mean, the little fish actually are really tough. But you know the toughest thing is stuff like this because matzah, actually, which we have had as a mystery ingredient, is a great ingredient because it's so bland and so
versatile.
And you just buzz it up in the food processor and make encrusted
Jewish panko.
Yeah, there you go. And I actually like matzah quite a bit. I would you can get far better matzah than this, of course, and we all know that.
Oh, now he's a connoisseur of matzah.
No, I'm not. Oh, actually, I didn't even look at the brand name, but I'm saying, I mean, you can go to restaurants. You can go to restaurants where they make house-made matzah that's cooked in a wood fire oven. I mean,
not in San Francisco, unfortunately. Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad.
Right.
We don't have enough Jews in San Francisco.
You would think we did.
You should recruit.
Okay.
Let's have another march through the desert. Because we have lots of them where I live.
Right.
But what I was getting at is that processed and pre-cooked foods are actually the worst mystery basket ingredients to me.
Right.
And yeah. Yes?
What's some of the best food you've ever eaten in San Francisco?
Oh, that's a good question. We were talking about this a little bit backstage because I work a lot. I work too much. And when I'm here even, I'm here so fast, usually, as I am on this trip, that I don't often get to sample the restaurants of the world the way I wish I could. I've had incredible meals at Ame, the seafood place in the St. Regis. The chef's name is Hiro. I believe he's
Hiro Soné.
Yeah, Beard Award winner. The woman who runs the place is amazing. I forget her name.
Lisa.
Yes.
His wife.
I'm good friends with Elizabeth Faulkner. I love her work. Let's see.
She's now in your neck of the woods, in Brooklyn.
She's defected from you to my neighbor, to Brooklyn. I apologize. I had nothing to do with it. She's a talented woman chef. There are not enough women chefs represented. We try so hard to get women chefs on Chopped. The fact is, there's the one woman chef for every 10 men. It's been historically a very macho, male-oriented profession, ironically, in a country where women are expected to cook at home for a large measure. But we're working on it. We're doing the best we can. San Francisco is a temple of cuisine. I mean, you're so lucky to live in a town.
You did the show food. Best Thing You Ever Ate. What is the worst thing you ever ate?
Again,
like where the expectations were, you're going to love this, and you're like, I am not going to love this.
We all have had so much bad food.
But like, what's sort of like the thing that I know you don't like liver. What are some of your other sort of?
Oh, just well, I actually like chicken livers in small doses. It's a very strong. I'm not going to eat a cow.
Fine, more for me.
No. It's a very strong, overwhelming flavor. I don't want a giant plateful of it. Mm-hmm. My father grew up. I grew up with a dad who loved fried chicken livers, and they would stink up the house. And I've got it's a phobia that I have. But a small amount of it, I like a lot. It's a very strong flavor. I don't want to eat a giant plateful of calf's liver. Ugh. I don't like those textures.
Hi, my question was, what are your thoughts on the foie gras ban that's coming into effect in California?
Ah, the last person to ask me that question was...
assassinated.
No. Yeah, get her. Yo, douche, get her. The last person to ask me that question is the woman who runs D'Artagnan, which is the foremost purveyor of foie gras in the country. And what I told her, she was asking me to... at the James Beard Awards, which you haven't even mentioned. I just won two of them. Or maybe you did.
I didn't. I have a whole thing here on all your awards. This man has so many awards. One of my friends, I asked a friend, anything you want to ask, because she was really sad she couldn't be here. So she sent in a bunch of questions. And the one question that she had was, you have all these awards from, you know, she mentioned your National Magazine Award for writing Male Breast Cancer.
Well, I didn't win that, but I was nominated.
Okay, you were nominated for that. Your Emmy for Queer Eye, your 2 James Beard Awards. Where do you put them? Emma Thompson puts her Oscars in the bathroom so people could, guests in her house could have a chance to do their own acceptance speech in the red. Where do you keep yours?
Tom Felicia keeps his Emmy in his bathroom because the wings that come up off of the angel will hold a roll of toilet paper perfectly. But no, so the last time someone asked me about foie gras was the woman who runs D'Artagnan, which is the foremost producer of foie gras in the United States, to my knowledge. And she was asking me to pin a pro foie gras button on my tuxedo. And the first time I got out of it without explaining myself, but she got me again. And finally I said, the reason I'm not going to put that button on my tux is that I have not ever read a scientifically sound, I am not yet aware of a scientifically sound research study into whether the process of making foie gras is or is not humane to animals. It sounds bad, force feeding geese. That sounds bad. I will tell you that the people who are making the decisions about whether to ban foie gras are rarely qualified to do so. Let me give you an example. The Chicago City Council, all right, which was subsequently overturned. I lived in Chicago. There are some very smart city council people in Chicago. There are some people in the City Council of Chicago that are not qualified to do anything, let alone discuss an issue of that kind of cultural complexity. And when you consider the importance that preparation holds in classical French cooking, it's not something to take lightly. It's also, for animal rights activists, to be fair, it's low-hanging fruit. It's really easy to take this rich person delicacy and ban it to make a point. But if they're abusing animals, and one more point about it that I do know for a fact, that geese naturally gorge themselves on food in the fall to prepare for the winter, and their liver does enlarge 2 or 3 times the size that it normally is. But the process of gavage, by which you force feed a goose on purpose to get foie gras, makes their liver 10 times the size. It doesn't sound nice to me. And so I don't feel informed enough as to whether that makes the animal suffer or not to say one way or the other. I would be delighted to read a study about it, but I don't know that there is one. The only ones I know of have been produced by the French, who obviously have some skin in the game. Jeffrey Steingarten wrote a really thoughtful piece about it once, but he still did not satisfy me whether it truly is or is not cruel. So that's where I come down.
So thanks to all of you for being here, Ted Allen and Joey Altman. Oh, my God. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a wonderful evening.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Ted Allen, host of the Food Network show Chopped, and whose latest book is In My Kitchen, 100 Recipes and Discoveries for Passionate Cooks. He was joined in conversation by chef and author Joey Altman. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia and David Kwan. David Kwan also edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature science writer Mary Roach in conversation with Jack Bulwar. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.